The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
So you and I today stand on the very cusp of what some say could be World War III. It's possible that we could witness such a thing. There's terrible destruction going on. There are tyrannical rulers in this world that would bring down death and destruction on humanity to exercise their will. I ask you today in this context, who do you think is the most dangerous man in the world today? Because some thought at one time it was Saddam Hussein, and so we touted that as a reason, of course, to go in there. Some today may think it's Korea, North Korea's leader, or Iran's leader is looking very much like he might be one of the most dangerous men. What do you think about when it relates to the Church of God? You know, some people thought Joseph de Koch was the most dangerous man in the world. But what do you think? Who do you think it is? Because I say this, there is a monumental truth, and it's this. A man, the most dangerous man, is on the earth today, right now. And you actually know who the man is. Because the most dangerous man is our old man. It's us. It's our carnal self that's inside us. That's the most dangerous man in the world to you and to me. See, because millions of people on earth, they don't think they're dangerous. They think, well, I'm a good person. I don't hurt people. But that's the deception. And that's why it's so cunning and so deceitful. You know, in World War II, it was Patton who had a great idea here. He was going to, of course, they were going to have D-Day. And so what they did was that they misled our enemy. We fed them false information. And we gave them the impression that we were going to have troop maneuvers in a different place around in the world. And so what happens is they thought the enemy was over there. But see, the enemy was really coming over here. This kind of distraction is one of the greatest tools that the devil can use for us. He does it to us. We think the enemy's somewhere else, don't we? We think it's in our family. We think it's that guy over there. We think it's that lady over there. We think it's our boss. We think it's President Bush sometimes. You understand my point? People think the enemy is outside of themselves, and they don't see that it's not outside. The most dangerous man or woman in the world is you and me. We're dangerous to ourselves because we're the one that can do the most danger to ourselves. I remember there was a book written I read in college. Joseph Conrad wrote the book, The Most Dangerous Game. Have any of you read that book? It was about a great hunter, and he had reached the pinnacle of the ability to hunt. He was very skilled. And he needed to find a game that was more cunning. So he decided he would hunt a man because they were as cunning as he was and as able to deceive and as able to be as smart as he was. And so he began to hunt men. And he has a point when Conrad wrote that book, that human beings are cunning and they're great at deceit. And he realized this, human beings are the most dangerous, aren't they? Yes. See, here's the problem, though. We get to thinking that we're the good guys and other people are the bad guys. So it's the boss at work, the neighbor, the mate, one of the brethren. But none of this is true. And I'll never forget the Pogo cartoon. I think I mentioned it a number of times because I think it's so appropriate. Here was Pogo, and he's standing in this boat, and he's at the bow, and he has one foot up, of course, and his sword in his hand, and he's looking forward in very heroic posture, and he says, we've met the enemy, and it's us. And it's so funny because it's so incredibly true. It's us that is the dangerous one. Here's why. No man, not one, can take you out of the Father's hand. Nobody can. John 10 and verse 27 says this. John 10, verse 27, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And I give unto them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall any man pluck them out of my hand. my Father which gave them to me is greater than all, and no man is able to pluck them out of my Father's hand. Wow, that's saying something, isn't it? It's like Christ is saying, nobody can take them out of my hand, but if you think I might be weak, my Father is in charge of all of this. He's not letting anybody. So it's saying this, nobody can pull you out. Nobody can snatch you away. Christ is a good shepherd. He'll take care of us. So no man, no woman on the face of the earth, no matter how powerful they may think they are, they can't touch us, can they? Not a single man that can destroy. Oh, they can kill you, can't they? Oh, they can torture you, do all kinds of damage to you, but they can't do any permanent damage to you that's inside. You remember Viktor Frankl? You remember the great lesson he learned when he was in the Holocaust and in those concentration camps? He was there naked after being tortured in a cell, and he realized something. He was a living being, and no one could take his identity from him. They could beat him and torture him. They could do anything. They could do anything to him, but they could not make him do anything back. And he began to treat those guards with respect, and he began to treat the other prisoners with respect, and he changed the entire camp's attitude by his attitude, because he realized this, no matter what they do to me externally, they can't touch me inside. It's an amazing thing, the power we have. Here's my point. They can do very little damage to us externally. So let's go to Matthew 10. Matthew 10 for a moment. We have the power of our own mind, our own identity. And we have the power to choose. And we can choose what we will do and how we will react to others, no matter what they might do to us. And so he says this, Jesus does to us in verse 28. Fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both the soul and the body in hell. And so the point is this. He's the one that has control of us. He's the one in whom we are in his hand. And nobody can take us out of that hand but one person. Right? We can let go of the hand. We can make the choice to walk away. We can make the choice. That's where the power lies. And that's why it can be so dangerous. You see, if we live in a way that is opposing God's way, then he may have to do what he said, and that is to destroy us. There's another case in point. Revelation 3 and verse 10. It says this, you've kept my word patiently. I'll keep you from the hour of temptation or tribulation that will come on the whole world to try them. Then he warns the people this, behold, I come quickly, hold fast what you have, so that nobody takes your crown. Think about this. See, people forget sometimes that we're not in this for salvation. The first resurrection are those people who are going to be Christ's staff. They're going to be rulers in the kingdom. So we're qualifying for positions of rulership, not just salvation. We're not just accepting salvation. And so there's a crown waiting for us. And that's what Paul said. He says, there is a crown waiting for him. But you get the point, is what he's saying? Don't let some other man take your crown. But no man can take your crown, can they? Because nobody can take you out of God's hand. But what happens if you vacate the position? If you vacate the position, then you get replaced and someone else is going to wear your crown. And that's what he's getting at. It's us that can do this, nobody else. So if we begin to act unworthy of the crown God has for us, if we begin to act in ways that are contrary to the government of God, we could lose our crown. Reuben lost his place as being the one to receive the birthright. Saul lost his place to David, didn't he? Judas lost his to Matthias. You see the problem? Some have lost their crown because of what they did. And my point today to us is, it's possible. And he says to us living at the end of the age, before the great tribulation or temptation that comes on all mankind, don't let anyone take your crown. Because we could lose our place, be replaced by someone else. So it's not about competition. No one's going to come along and steal our position. But we can abdicate by our behavior. We can deceive ourselves. Matthew 24. We can deceive ourselves, and that's where I think one of the biggest problems lies. Matthew 24, the time of incredible deception coming. Matthew 24 and verse 24 says this: For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and they'll show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they would deceive the very elect. And you see the point I'm making here, if we go to 1 Corinthians. It appears like the scripture is saying that it's not possible to deceive the very elect. 1 Corinthians 3. Nobody can come from outside, can they, and convince you, you know what? You ought to be keeping Christmas. You should be worshiping Ishtar right now. Get some eggs. No one's going to do that to you. You're not going to be deceived by that, are you? There's no way that can happen. So where's the enemy? Where's the threat? Where's the danger really coming from? It's coming from here, 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 18. Let no man deceive himself. If any man among you seems to be wise in the world, let him become a fool that he may become wise. You see it? Nobody's going to deceive you, except for one person. Your old friend, the old man, the man that you put into the grave, in that watery grave. So we're dangerous to ourselves. You know, we've always been taught this, haven't we? We knew this. We had three enemies. The world and its pulls, right, is an enemy in a sense. There's the pull of Satan the devil, his influence, his broadcasting, as it were, as the prince of the power of the air, broadcasting emotions and anger and hostility that we can tune into, pick up, mirror, as it were. And the other enemy was ourself. And I suggest again, the one that's the most difficult to watch is the one that is the self. And he'll work on us that way. He'll attack us even using self, Satan does. And so we struggle with lust. And we struggle with envy. And we struggle with ego. And so many times this happens, isn't it? You notice the ads on television and in the movies now and in the magazines are always telling you, you need to satisfy yourself. You deserve to have the right car. You have to have the right home. You have to have the right tennis shoes and the right kind of dress. And you have to have the right deodorant, of all things, right? Because you got to be secure. You feel better about yourself. And have the right status and all of that. Have a facade so that we feel good about ourselves. And it's all because human nature is like that. We want to feel good about ourselves. And it's all about us so many times. Here's the root of the problem. Let's go to Psalm 39. God created us, and he made human nature the way it is. I know human nature has been perverted by Satan's influence in this world that we grew up in. But human nature itself, actually, the carnal mind, that is enmity against God and the law of God, as it says in Romans 8. Here's some insightful comments about us. Psalm 39 and verse 4. Of course, it'd be better if I was in Psalms and not Job. Psalm 39 and verse 4. Lord, make me to know my end and the measure of my days, what it is that I may know how frail I am. Behold, you've made my days as a handbreadth, and my age is as nothing before you. Truly, every man at his best state is altogether vanity. In one sense, there's not much to us when we consider spirit beings, and look how long we last. My machine is wearing out. I'm getting tired and old now. And there's others older than me. So there's physical limits that we have to deal with. And this physical body that we have is interesting, especially when it comes to human nature. We operate on a certain principle, and it's this. It's the pain-pleasure principle. You're familiar with that? We love pleasure and we seek it, right? We hate pain and we avoid it. And so this is always at work in us. No matter where we go, we're always going to take the choice that benefits us and gives us the most pleasure, and the one that gives us the least pain, you know. And so life overall, if we don't do anything about it, becomes kind of guided by this principle. We'll avoid pain at any cost and seek pleasure as much as we can. And of course, I've talked before about the defense mechanism that is in us, that we want to avoid pain so much, and we're designed this way so that we automatically pull our hand out of the fire, don't we? So the mind works automatically to do these things. We'll automatically protect ourselves from any danger. Well, what happens in business because of this principle? Well, I have to take advantage of him before he takes advantage of me, right? Isn't that what happens? Isn't it that if they hurt me, I have to hurt them back? And you're only really defending yourself to do it, you see? And so this is what happens over and over again. The vanity will do this. It will even want to protect us from seeing ourselves. You ever done that? Where you go along and all of a sudden somebody's really angry at you? And you don't have any idea why they're angry at you. And then they tell you, you did such and such. You go, what? You never even realized. We're walking all over people's toes. We're doing things to hurt them. We don't even know it. Because why? Because our focus is on us and getting the best for us. We're sometimes not even thinking about others, you see. And this is how we can get into loads and loads of trouble. And this is why. It says in Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is deceitful and wicked. Who can know it? And by that, you see, there is this defense. Go ahead and ask yourself, you know, what kind of person am I? What's the first reaction? I'm a good person. Remember what Jesus said when he was human? There's not one good, not one. Not if you really know the depths of what humans are able to do in the name of righteousness. The war that's going on right now, the innocent victims that are being killed, because look at the statistics in the war. Do you think most of these are soldiers that are dying? No. There was a little man, an old elderly man riding his bicycle that got hit by a rocket. 3 children that got hit. Just civilians, innocent people are dying. But we have to protect ourselves, you see. And so we go to war in order to protect ourselves. And we go to war in our families. We go to war at work. We go to war in the church of God with other people. All in the name of seeking what's best for us and doing what we want to do for ourselves. And so this defense mechanism will protect us from pain of any sort. People drink to numb the pain, don't they? And they have the pain. But then look at the pain they cause other people. You see what I'm getting at, how this works. And so we'll justify ourselves, won't we? I mean, if we do something wrong, we know it's wrong, and we get caught at it, they'll tell us, hey, you did this wrong, but we have a reason, don't we? We have a reason, and we can justify it. But you understand, if all this kind of behavior continues on and on and on, we can build ourselves a pathway, believing we're doing good, believing we're okay, and the path is going to lead us to destruction, and we'll never see it. And that's why we need to challenge ourselves about these things. I'll never forget how I remember the first time it really struck me as a young boy in the Navy, and I used to go ashore with Heinrich. He was a German guy, and Heinrich was he was a character for sure, but he had the funniest haircut and the funniest teeth in front. He was like really pointed, and his hair was really a funny color to me. And so Heinrich and I are talking about what all the sailors talk about, right? Girls. And we're talking about girls, and the subject came up about who was better looking. And he and I began to argue. I knew I was better looking than that character, right? I knew it. And, I know I'm nothing at all. And I wasn't then, even when I was young. I just wasn't very attractive. But that guy, you could beat, okay? So we got in this very heated discussion, and I called over some of the other sailors. I said, you got to settle this for us. I know I'm a winner here. Tell me, who's better looking, Heinrich or me? Everyone to a man said, he's way better looking than you are. Now, how did I deceive myself like that? How? It's human nature, isn't it? We think very highly of ourselves, and we can't really see. The heart is deceitful, you see, and wicked. It doesn't see it the way it really is. It makes us rose-colored, sort of, you know. Anyway, that was a little bit of a shock. It would have been different if it was Brad Pitt, but it was Heinrich. Really embarrassing. So we tend to think what we are is good, and who we are is good, and what we, as they teach today in the self-esteem world, the world of self-esteem, you have to love yourself before you can love someone else, and the people somehow get caught up loving themselves, and they forget the other person. That's what happens. It does. We love ourselves. We cherish ourselves. And so this is kind of what we are having to fight if we really want to be successful Christians. So God didn't build exactly this deceit in the human heart, but it's there, and it's a part of the defense mechanism. And we will cause us to, it'll cause us to be in denial. Let's go to James 1 about things. I remember the story Mr. Armstrong told about the truth. And he's talked about in terms, I remember once about, how did he put that? He said, some people in life will go along and they'll stumble over the truth. And then they'll quickly get up, dust themselves off, and continue on as if nothing ever had occurred. And how true that can be. It's the defense mechanism. We don't want to see it because it would cause us pain to see the truth. James 1 and verse 22. Be you doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves, because ourselves are the ones that can deceive us, and that's how we can mess up, go the wrong direction, and lose our crown. For if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer of the word, he's like unto a man beholding his natural face in a glass. For he beholds himself, and he sees the dirt and the smudges and all the stuff there that needs to be cleaned up. But he beholds himself, and then he goes his way and straightway forgets what manner of man he was. What an incredible, insightful point that James makes for us. Well, why do we do that? We look in the mirror, and we think we're okay. We think we're okay. Was it me, or was it you that gave that message about looking in the mirror? Well, anyway, I'll just re-say it again. I remember as a young man doing this once. Have you ever done that? Look at yourself in the mirror and say, who are you? Really face yourself. Look deep into yourself and ask yourself who you are. It's a fascinating exercise to just be completely open with yourself. So imagine this. We look in the mirror, as I do, and I see we're hopelessly out of shape. Our clothes are torn. There's dirt and smudges and smears all over us. We take note of it. We turn around, and we walk out the door and go apply for a job as a bank manager. Right? I mean, that's crazy sounding. But you understand my point, the point I make, how we color ourselves with the rose-colored glasses because of this trait that we have. And so we will see ourselves in the best light. We deserve the place in line. We deserve the front position. And I remember going to Disneyland. I don't know when the last time you went was, but it wasn't too long ago I went. And I remember watching people shove and push their way to get to the front of the line. Actually push people out of the way and get to the front of the line. And you know what? They had this smug, confident look on their face. They had done something right. They felt good about what they had done, because they had gotten a place that they believed they should have. But that's the point I make. We wouldn't do that, would we? No. It's kind of like too obvious. We're more subtle in some of the things that we do. And we are more subtle, but we do some of the similar things. I remember the story Mr. Armstrong told. He was, of course, beginning to hobnob with the wealthy, and he liked it. Do you remember reading in the autobiography? And he got up to like $35,000 a year, which you can imagine back in his day would be like close to 800 or something, 700,000 or something. I don't know, but It would be probably 10 or 20 times that, maybe 300,000 years. So he was really becoming successful. He was running with the rich. He was running with the super leaders. And he was beginning to really think he was somebody. And then God pulled one thing after another. One deal after another failed. One job after another failed. And then he's finally down on the, you know, as low as he thought he could go. And his wife comes home and says, "Herbert, we got to keep the Sabbath." She had found out some brethren. And he went, "Oh no, what do you think he was thinking?" You know what he said he was thinking? "If I start keeping the Sabbath, people will think I'm weird. None of my old friends will want anything to do with me anymore. This can't happen." So he went on a campaign to disprove the Sabbath to his wife, and he had to admit it in the end. No, there's no evidence. He had to admit he had been totally wrong. And I'm going to read this out of the autobiography. He said, "To accept this truth meant I'd be cut off from all former friends and business associates. I saw plainly what a decision that was before me. To accept this truth meant to throw in my lot for life with a class of people I'd always looked on as inferior. I learned later that God looks on the heart, and that these humble people were the real salt of the earth. But I was then still looking on the outward appearance, but then I had been beaten down. I had been humiliated. I had been broken in spirit and frustrated, and I had come to look on this formerly esteemed self as a failure. I now took another good look at myself." I bet he went to the mirror, and I bet he looked and he stared right in his eyes and said, "Who are you? What do you really care about? What are you seeking? What are you after?" And then he said this, "I acknowledged I'm nothing but a burned out old hunk of junk. I realized that I had been a swelled headed, egotistical jackass." Well, I can relate to that. "Finally, in desperation, I threw myself on God's mercy and I said to God that I knew now that I was nothing but a burned out hunk of junk. My life was worth nothing more to me. And I said to God that I now knew I had nothing to offer him. But I would, if he would forgive me, if he could have any use for me, this worthless dreg of humanity, that he could have my life. And I meant it. It was a tough battle, the toughest I'd ever fought. It was a battle for life, and I lost that battle, as I had been recently losing all my battles. I realized that Jesus Christ had bought and paid for my life, and I gave in. I surrendered unconditionally, and I told Christ he could have what was left of me." And that's what happens when we compare ourselves to God's glory. I remember it was really interesting in the reading, wasn't it? The way Mr. Moore phrased that about the pride. When it talked about they'll fear and their heart will be enlarged. I just related to that so much. It was so beautiful. So anyway, let's go to Galatians 6. We're no different than Mr. Armstrong. We maybe didn't travel in some of the high levels that he traveled in, but we traveled in the same mess of humanity that is our human nature and our ego that he traveled in and had. We all have the same malady, if you'll let me say it that way. In verse 3 of chapter 6 of Galatians, "If a man thinks himself to be something when he's nothing, he deceives himself." And so our pride becomes our enemy. Mr. Armstrong surrendered to God completely. And that's what we have to do as well. People today will argue for hours over the smallest details. Ever read some of the accounts where people will shoot somebody? It was over an argument. It could be a pack of cigarettes, or who owes somebody $100, or, you know, something so small sometimes. But the reason is it's hard to look at ourselves objectively and see ourselves for what we are. And that's why the proverb says this: "Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord ponders the heart." And so we can justify our actions all we want, can't we? But he's looking at our heart. What was your real motive for what you did, really? I know you have this that you tell everybody. What really was it? And so for this reason, we're told to examine ourselves every year at Passover, to really take a good, hard, cold, objective look. But shouldn't we do that more often? Shouldn't we do it all the time? It amazes me sometimes. It just amazes me. Go to Romans 3, if you will. I'll tell you this story. I had a number of churches at one time, and one of the churches far away and long ago in a different universe, if you will, there was a lady who did something wrong. She knew she did it wrong, and everyone knew about it. But some of the people began to ostracize her because of this. And they said that they, I remember one lady said to me when I went up and gave a sermon on love and forgiveness and things like that, and one lady said, Mr. Bradick, you know, it says right here that you're not to have fellowship with the sinner, and you're not to have fellowship with them, and you're not to eat with them, and so they couldn't have them into their house. And eventually this couple, and one couple that was so against this lady who had made a mistake in her life, they were so against her, they were actually became too good for the whole church. And they eventually left, of course. They left the rest of those sinners behind. But here's the point in Romans 3, verse 9. It says this, "What then? Are we better than they?" See what they forget? See what we can forget? "No, in no way, for we have before both proved the Jew and Gentile that all are under sin, as it is written. There's none righteous, no, not one." So the point is that we've got to be careful about who we are. We're the one that's the problem. We're the one that is the biggest enemy. Because out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, adulteries, and so on. And so today I want to remind all of us that the real fight isn't with the person who's hurting us, the person that's stepping on our toes, denying us the promotion that we wanted. It isn't with a mate who's telling us the truth about ourselves. You see, that's not the enemy. It's not the person that's outside. It is us that becomes the enemy. God, He's our friend. Go to Psalm 139, if you will. Here's what a brave soul was able to say. And it takes a brave soul. "God is our friend, and He'll help us overcome. And He knows what we're made of. He knows our frame." It's not like He's shocked to know who we are or to see what we do. It's not like He's shocked. So we needn't be shocked either. It's okay to see ourselves. It's okay to challenge ourselves and see who we really are. But one brave soul said this to God, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And see if there's any wicked way in me, and lead me then into the way of everlasting." Well, we should have that kind of nerve. I know Mr. Moore asked God, "God, show me." He's always asking God to show me my faults. And of course, I've kind of eased up on that after a few calamities. And where I saw them. anyway, Romans 8, if you would. Our enemy is Satan. Our enemy is the pulls, the glitter, the glitz of this world that we think we need so much of. And the enemy is also ourselves. And so it says something in Romans 8 that I think is deeply encouraging. In verse 35, "Nobody can take us out of His hand." Nobody can. "Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? As it is written, 'For your sake we're killed all the day long. We're accounted as sheep for the slaughter.' But in all of these things we're more than conquerors through Him that loved us. For I'm persuaded that neither death or life or angels or principalities or powers or things present or even the things that are going to come, nor height or depth or any creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus our Lord." Nothing can separate us from our God. There isn't anybody or any power, but there is one person, and that is us. We have the propensity. We have, in our human nature, the ability to fool ourselves, deceive ourselves, and to rationalize it and justify it. And so today, I'm asking us to take a look. Take a look and ask yourself, how are we doing in this area? Or are we blaming others? Are we pointing the fingers out at others? Or do we see ourselves as the one that we really, the only one we can work on? and the one we need to be careful about, the one we need to be guarded against. Because we've seen the enemy, and it's us.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the message beneficial. If you would like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we would like to hear from you. You may contact us at 1-800-723-6108. We also invite you to visit our website at eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.